hjws.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. General Electric's former chairman Jack Welch has been called manager of the century and a business magician. He's also been described as the man who elevated unvarnished Darwinism to a business philosophy. He led GE for more than 20 years, changing its focus from manufacturing to services and putting it on a path to globalization and a legendary string of profits. But they didn't call him Neutron Jack for nothing. Tonight on Point, Jack Welch on American corporate culture now and why it's time to celebrate a U.S. economic recovery. But first, we begin in Iraq, where yesterday 16 American soldiers bound for 2 weeks of Pentagon-ordered vacation died when their helicopter was shot down in Fallujah, 30 miles west of Baghdad. And new violence today, explosions reported in Baghdad and Karbala, and the U.S. servicemen killed by a mine in Tikrit. New York Times reporter Alex Berenson was in Fallujah yesterday and spoke with me today from Baghdad. I asked him how the U.S. military has responded to the downing of an American helicopter.
Well, there are certainly a lot more military presence on the streets today. It seems like there's a statement that the U.S. military is trying to make that they will not be intimidated by this, that they are going to be aggressive. I've seen battle tanks on the streets of Baghdad and a lot of Humvees, which you do see sometimes, but I've definitely seen more of them today. You know, at the same time, there's definitely a lot of nervousness on the part of soldiers, and you can see that when you approach them in situations that are chaotic. There is definitely a tension. They're definitely apt to, you know, to sort of train their weapons on you and to discourage you from getting too close.
And what about the reaction of Iraqis to the helicopter's downing? And let's start in Fallujah, where you were yesterday. What kinds of responses did you see and hear?
Well, in Fallujah, they're happy about it. There's no two ways about it. They are happy that helicopter got shot down. They're happy that Americans died. They would like nothing more for more Americans to die. These are people who didn't really like this occupation to begin with. They're mostly Sunni Muslims. The Sunnis benefited under Saddam, although a lot of these people are still very poor. But they weren't happy with us to begin with. And since the occupation began, there's been a number of violent incidents between U.S. soldiers and people in and around Fallujah that have worsened the animosity, frankly.
Did you see celebration, or what kind of remarks did you hear to persuade you they were glad?
The most striking thing that I heard from someone was he said, you know, my son is already throwing stones at U.S. soldiers. Imagine what he's going to do when he grows up, you know, implying also that he thought we'd still be there when his son grows up.
Alex, can you tell us one more time exactly how this happened? What's known now about how the helicopter was shot down?
What's known is not much. The U.S. military has not confirmed much on the record. But what witnesses tell us is that two shoulder fire missiles were launched out of a sort of a heavy grove of palm trees in a field of farms west of Fallujah. It's a very beautiful country, actually. And the helicopters fly quite low. Actually, in an effort to ensure their safety, they try to fly low and fast. But whoever did this probably had tracked the helicopters coming and going, it seems, because there were two missiles fired at two helicopters. And, you know, that indicates presumably that whoever did this didn't just happen upon this. These were shoulder-fired missiles by the accounts of the witnesses, and they locked on. One of them missed. The other one locked on to the rear of the Chinook and either blew out the engine or blew off the rotor. There are sort of differing witness accounts. And then the helicopter crashed. You know, it was less than 100 yards above the ground. It crashed and burned. And, you know, it was quite a terrible incident from the point of view of the U.S. soldiers on board. It was, you know, everyone on board was either injured or killed.
What about back in Baghdad? What response did you see there to the downing? Did you hear?
You know, in Baghdad, most people want the violence to end. I don't necessarily think they want the United States to stay forever, but, you know, most people in Baghdad are happy that Saddam Hussein is gone, and they wish that the United States could effectively end the violence that has followed, you know, which is widely seen here as being the work of foreign fighters and the work of Saddam's men, who were not well-liked. I mean, not well-liked is an understatement. They were hated here by most Iraqis. And so I think most people just shake their heads and say, you know, it's another bad day. You know, Americans died Sunday. Last Monday, a number of Iraqis and Iraqi police died. The violence just seems to be continuing. And the United States does not seem to have a, you know, an effective way of stopping it right now. But there certainly is not the same kind of happiness that there is in Fallujah and in the Sunni Triangle.
And what about in Baghdad today? More reports of explosions. What's known about what's going on there today?
Well, about 2 hours ago, about 9 p.m. local time here, there were several large explosions that seemed to come from fairly near where the New York Times bureau is, which is just across the river from the palace where the American occupying authorities are based. It's a little tricky because at night the sound of explosions carries further, and so sometimes something that sounds quite loud and quite close can actually be a good distance away. Now, a photographer and I went out to try to see what happened. We couldn't find it. Other reporters apparently have not been able to find it, and the occupying authorities just sent out an email to the press corps here saying there were three explosions. We have no reports of injuries or damage. So, you know, it's just some thumps in the night, and that is not unusual here. There have been mortars, I would guess, maybe three or four times in the last 10 days. It's getting to be a feature of nightlife in Baghdad.
That is mortar fire against U.S. concentrations or facilities.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a little hard to know because it's the middle, you know, it's nighttime and you can't see where they land and you can't see where they're launched from. But they mainly seem to be directed at the palace, the Republican palace grounds where U.S. authorities are staying. Now, you know, once these things are put up in the air, they can land just about anywhere and they can do a lot of damage. But the people who are putting them up don't seem to mind that particularly.
Alex, help us put all of this in perspective. 31 American soldiers killed in the last 10 days. It can seem sometimes from way over here that things are out of control. Is that right? Are these pinpricks on a larger stable operation? How do you see what's going on?
No, things are not out of control, but they are getting worse. I don't think after the last 10 days anyone could disagree with that. I've been here for a couple of months, and my impression for most of my time here was that things were getting better, and frankly that we in the press probably weren't doing as good a job as we could at putting the whole picture together, that security was a concern, but that the CPA, the occupying authority, was making progress. In the last 10 days, though, it's become clear that security is really the only issue right now, that if the United States can't stop the car bombs and can't protect its troops and can't protect civilians in a better way than it's been doing, then the progress that's been made is tenuous at best. So, you know, I do think that people in the States have an impression that, you know, it's chaos and there's fighting in the streets, and that is not true. I mean, you know, most of Baghdad is a large city, and at any given time, most of it is quite peaceful. But the situation is turning worse, and there has been more open violence in the suburbs, the west of Baghdad. There have been more attacks in Fallujah. And, you know, these car bombs were a very big deal last week because if the police can't protect themselves, if the Iraqi police can't protect themselves, I think citizens here can legitimately ask if they can protect anybody else. So somewhere in between chaos and pinpricks.
Alex, good luck to you there, and thank you for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Alex Berenson is covering the American occupation of Iraq for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Baghdad. Jack Welch is a legend in business circles with an up-by-the-bootstrap story. He grew up in Salem, Massachusetts, went to the University of Massachusetts, and then to the University of Illinois, where he got a Ph.D. in chemical engineering. He joined General Electric as an engineer in 1960, rose quickly, and in 1981 became chairman. Welch pursued a fix, sell, or close strategy, pumping money into high-margin service businesses, slashing jobs in GE's low-margin manufacturing divisions, and aggressively moving the company into the global economy. Welch retired in 2001, although temporarily knocked off his pedestal by reports of his generous post-retirement pay package. He is back and in fighting form. After everything that's emerged from America's shop floors, executive suites, and boardrooms in the last 2 years, is Jack Welch still the platinum standard of corporate leadership for you? Did you sleep with the maxims of Chairman Jack at your bedside? Do you agree with him that it's time to celebrate an economic recovery? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the On Point studio is the former General Electric chairman named Manager of the Century by Fortune magazine in 1999. Good evening and welcome, Jack Welch.
Good evening, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Manager of the Century. That's a pretty broad swath, Jack. But then you got used to amazing compliments, amazing accolades like that in the last years of your time at GE. When you look back on that and you look back on all the cheering and swaying and uproar of the late 90s, were we all a little bit overboard or was there something real there?
Tom, I don't think you're probably ever as good as your press or ever as bad as your press. I think these
whether it's Jack Welch or the U.S. economy?
Well, I think I've got a different view of the U.S. economy right now, but I do think that we all get pendulum swings. If you weren't in a internet stock in 1999, you were a dope, and mm-hmm. everyone was calling you a dope. And if you were in an old company like GE, you were in an old economy company, and you had to be a new economy person. So I think that ups and downs, swings and sways are a part of the economic cycle and life cycle.
You certainly had a lot of the upside. Right now, and there's so much I want to talk with you about tonight, but I want to get to the point you've made recently in public. You said that the U.S. Is stuck or is tarred in a way in what you call the butt economy. Explain what that is and what's the problem.
Tom, I think that we are seeing a real recovery here, by no means complete and fixed, in the early stages of it. And there are millions of people out there. I've spoken to 200,000 people in audiences with Q&As for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And you see these people working desperately hard to get their companies righted after a tough economic period. And many of them are doing a real job of getting there. They're not all the way there by any means. But the basic thesis I was trying to make is things are a lot better in lots of places, and we don't have to, with every new, nice, positive release, add the but word. But earnings were up, but sales were up, but the competitive environment, that we're winning, but there's a time for people to enjoy the fruits of what they're doing. I think we forget too often that companies aren't buildings. Mm-hmm. Tom, they're people. They got flesh and blood. They need the encouragement for what they're doing because they're fighting a very tough global battle.
Why do you think that but is there so often after descriptions of the economy these days? Even last week when we had, 7.4% growth in the third quarter, we still talked with economists who said, but watch out, there's this, there's that. Is that still the gun shy, the sting of the bust of the great fall of 2-3 years ago?
Well, I think there are two things. I think there, as I tried to point out in the Wall Street Journal editorial, I think there are two things. One is that nobody wants to get burned. The analyst community, the journalist community, who are all guilty of the hyping the last bubble, if you will, of the internet stocks. And secondly, look, you're coming up on election year, and the country's polarization is probably never been worse. It was tough in the Clinton years. It's as Republicans bashed the president. Mm-hmm. It's difficult now. Talk radio in the morning is on all day espousing the Republican views, and you're reading other things that are the other side. Mm-hmm. But it's probably never been as divisive, I don't think.
Even during the trough of the Clinton years when the impeachment was underway and all that, you think that the party polarization or Americans' perspective polarization is worse now?
I think it's, if not worse, just as bad. It's awful.
And that's pretty bad indeed. Do you think there's reason, though, for caution still, Jack Welch? Or are you saying, hey, it's all sunbeams now. We've got this thing licked. We're over the hump. The economy is going to be roaring back.
Of course there's reasons for caution. I mean, we can't. But it's doing quite well. 7.2 is a remarkable number. I had no idea when I wrote that editorial mm-hmm. it was going to
what
be 7.2.
Right. Okay? You were looking at earnings from Xerox.
And mm-hmm. Lucent and others.
Right.
And I didn't know. That was very fortuitous that I wrote
this.
You
looked like a genius once again.
Right. You look like a real smart guy. And then the next day comes that. But I'll tell you that things are good. And we won't do 7.2. But if we do 4, 4, or 5, we'll be doing quite well.
Jack Welch, stand by. We're talking tonight with former GE Chairman Jack Welch, business legend and author of much of America's contemporary corporate culture. Do you agree with Jack Welch that it's time to celebrate the U.S. recovery? Do you sleep with the maxims of Chairman Jack at your bedside? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former GE Chairman Jack Welch, business legend and author of much of America's contemporary corporate culture. You can join the conversation tonight. What's your question for the business titan, fortune called the manager of the century? And are you happy to live in the American corporate culture that Jack built? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Welch, a lot of questions here about your legacy, about how your messages, which you beat the drum for nonstop at GE, very loudly and very effectively, how they were translated out, what they meant for the broader American corporate culture. You have watched, like all of us, in the last couple of 3 years when all this stuff has come out of the cupboards that looked awfully ugly. First, the market crash, and then this parade of ugly accounting, of unethical behavior. I mean, just in the last few days, we have even the mutual fund industry kind of, in some degrees, coming apart at the seams. You know, very, very highly paid executives who were managing stuff that just doesn't look right at all. Why? Why does American corporate culture have this big, nasty smell about it at the moment, and what relates back to some interpretation of what Jack Welch was saying for 20 years and what doesn't?
Well, look, I think you start off any institution with integrity. So let's begin there. And you assume and you drive through the company integrity. And that is at the heart of what I tried to preach at GE. And candor and openness with every employee was always at the heart of everything that we did. One of the things that I preach is that every employee should know where they stand. Everyone should know how they fit in the organization and whether they have opportunity, whether they don't, where they're going, and not be – people think letting people know where they stand in an organization is tough management. I say it's kind management. I think
so. When you say where they stand, you mean if they're not standing in a good position, tell them so.
Tell them so. Tell them how they can improve. Give them a chance to improve. And if they don't, ask them to move on to another place. Tom, you're not doing anyone a favor carrying them along and then all of a sudden changing their life with it as the economy changes. One of the things that's misunderstood is that winning is very good. Companies winning is a very positive thing. Employees give back. They are happy. They mentor kids in schools. The company pays taxes. All good things happen when companies win. When companies lose, towns get devastated. People aren't worried about giving back. They're worried about their own jobs. The insecurities are enormous. The greatest thing you can give a company is a winning culture.
But okay, you've got two things on the table there. Let's pick them up one
at
a time. First, this winning culture. In some ways, Jack Welch, didn't your tenure show that companies can win and still devastate towns with changes in jobs and moving things overseas and being tough about what's working and what's not? I mean, in some ways, didn't the last dozen years of the American economy show the American economy could win and at the same time, boy, you talk about people watching their backs now for their job. I mean, that's happening even though the economy won. Is it possible? What do you make of that? Sitting around and losing isn't the only way to lose jobs anymore.
No, but John, 20 million jobs were created in the 90s, okay? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's an enormous amount of jobs. Jobs change. Look, in Massachusetts, the shoe industry, the leather industry left. The fabrics left to the south and then went overseas. We will change the type of work we do is we as a developed country go up the food chain. We were in Pittsfield, Mass., which is a town that was hurt a lot. I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
We lost money for 20 years in the transformer business. Now, that wasn't doing anyone any good. People were hanging on. They're wondering about their jobs. And today we have a winning transformer business with sales and marketing, manufacturing in Mexico, sales and marketing in the U.S., jobs created. From that standpoint, from production standpoint, no. We couldn't compete. We were losing money.
On the manufacturing.
On the manufacturing side.
But do you see, with the perspective you've got now, you've been out at least at the margins looking back for a couple of years here, is there a tension that didn't work out entirely well between winning, all the emphasis on winning, and Lord knows you've got to win in the end business if you want to succeed, but on the other hand, this the integrity piece. Because we see in many companies now, integrity went out the window. Winning, or at least the appearance of winning, seemed to take over. I mean, just look at the list of companies where the accounting was a mess, where all kinds of shenanigans were going on. Was it, did somehow we put so much emphasis on winning that the integrity piece got forgotten?
Tom, it didn't happen in companies with formative cultures. It just didn't happen. Let's take some of the examples. Arthur Andersen was a great accounting firm. It decided to become an auditing firm. It changed. It was in court deciding how to bust up the profits with the partners. Mm-hmm. All these, the major number of companies that had the problems, Enron, it was a good pipeline company. They got bored and became a trading company. WorldCom was a fine telephone company that all of a sudden somebody from Hattiesburg, Mississippi, puts together some deals on Wall Street and cooks up another company with no culture.
But you could say, well, General Electric was a fine manufacturing company that became a financial services company and everything else. But in GE's case, it didn't go off the rails on the ethical front. Why did it go off the rails at so many other companies? Were they listening to Jack Welch and hearing the wrong thing? Were they misinterpreting you?
No, Tom. Jack, you're giving me way too much credit, first of all.
I don't know, manager of the century.
No.
You've got a lot of publicity out there.
But listen, take IBM, take DuPont, take companies that have long-standing cultures. You don't see – no, they have their little – blips like we all do in GE, but you have a system and a culture, Tom, that deals with it. It is part of the ingrained. These companies were new companies, new models on new companies.
But you've been a champion of the new, of change. That surely includes new companies. I mean, why wouldn't new companies come in and feel a general corporate culture in the United States that would say, no, there's no way we can do that?
Some did. Dell, Cisco,
true.
Some great companies. Look, and some didn't. I mean, you've had bad apples for centuries, okay, and since the day of the first birth.
But that was a heck of a crop in the last couple
of
3 years.
No, Tom, maybe a larger amount, but it feels that way now, but I think it was that way in the I remember the Billy Saul Estes mess. I remember all these things. I'm old enough now mm-hmm. to have been through some cycles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are bad actors that are out there in a number of these things, and you just got to go through it, clean it out. We're going through the mm-hmm. purge now. We're going through the trials. We're doing stuff to clean this up.
Do you think the fix is working? Sarbanes-Oxley, is it going to work, or is it going to gum up American corporations and make them look over their shoulder and spend so much time on accounting that they can't compete?
It's going to do both. And the question is, has it swung too far? But it's going to. We needed something like that to restore confidence. We've got to restore confidence in the investor and in the country. But you know, you talk about American coming. In Europe, they've been putting guys on trial for the last 5 years. Russia, we just had a huge mess.
Still every melting way, down over.
Every way you look, you're looking at these sorts of things. We have, in this country, the best system going. And it's got its flaws. Capitalism has its flaws. But it's the best system going.
Are you saying then what we've seen in the last few years is just part of the package? We've got to accept it? It's going to show up every 25 years?
No. We got to do everything we can to not have it happen. And we got to teach right from wrong and on your mother's knee, through school, through everywhere. And people have got to understand it.
Jack Welch, let me ask you about money and compensation.
Yeah.
You've got such a colorful history. Many people know it from your autobiography, Jack. You tell a story there of how in 1961 you'd finished up your PhD at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. You'd driven out in your black Volkswagen with your new wife. I think you were married by then.
Yeah.
You set up house in Pittsfield, Massachusetts as the junior guy. And a year later, when the salary came in, you were making $10,500
right.
or something. And your bonus for that year, when you thought you'd done pretty darn well, was $1,000. And you were happy enough with that until you found out that everyone else made the same salary. And then the very young Jack Welch went ballistic. You were ready to quit. Now, they came in and did all kinds of triage and kept you there at GE. But the lesson you took away from that, and you must have had it earlier, was reward people well when they do well. Don't stint on it. So
don't. The word in one word is differentiate. Differentiate. When you've got a star performer, pay them. Reward them in the soul and in the wallet. So, and the same is true when you have a bad performer. Do not don't give everybody the same.
So how has that worked out? I mean, it worked out pretty well for you. You're a near billionaire. But then, you know, we saw the flap over your post-retirement package and the big apartment and the flowers and the vase and all that. I mean, Nell Minow came down on you very hard. It is appalling to me that Jack Welch's flowers are being paid for by retired firemen and teachers who are the GE shareholders and don't know that this is going on. By your emphasis on differentiation, did you, and your own compensation, did you help encourage the kind of what looks like a plague of outsized pay packages, which may or may not be deserved in many executives?
Let me stop you right there on mine. You're not going to just leave that one talking.
Come back to it.
All right. My retention package, which was signed in 95 and published in the proxy, known to all.
This is when they wanted you to stay on for a few more years, when you're ready to retire.
Exactly.
You had a quintuple bypass.
And they wanted to give me all this money. And I said, no, just let me keep what I got. And it was published. It was published it's in the SEC website. It's published in the proxy every year, the entire contract.
I won't argue with you here that it was secret, but you know it made a heck of a splash when it came out. It made such a splash that you walked away from most
of it. It didn't come out, Tom. What happened was it was published every year by the Wall Street Journal, by Business Week and others. It was part of a divorce.
Right.
And it was a carefully done, nice job by divorce lawyers.
The torpedo hit the mark.
It was a good job.
You mean but they came out with all the details.
Same stuff, the exact same stuff that was published.
But it hit the papers in an entirely different way.
And
you know that very well because you stepped up and you very publicly said, look, I believe this is right, but perception is important. And I'm going to walk away from all these elements of that package because it's just not washing with the public. And you did it. But the question I'm asking, the deeper question is, did your emphasis on differentiation end up leaving people who didn't deserve those big packages with an awful lot of money? We've got the head of Putnam here in Boston who just had, what, four, five, six, I'm not sure what the number is, billion pulled out in the last few days, made $100 million in the last 5 years. He's been booted.
I can't speak for what the head of Putnam made versus the head of Fidelity versus what their competitive environment was. All I know is that none of those people come to work under gunpoint. And all those people go to work in a competitive environment, and they're paid a certain amount of money. And somebody else decides that they're worth more, they'll leave.
Did pay get out of control in American executive suites in the last half of the 90s?
What bothers me more than the I can't justify any level of pay, okay? There's no such thing as saying how much somebody's worth. Somebody's worth what the market will play. Is Manny worth as much as Manny gets? Is the shortstop worth as much as Nomar worth as much as he gets? Should Alex Rodriguez get $125,000? $125 million.
But you've said the market, but more important, you've said is performance. You've said reward performance. Do you see examples where the pay outstripped the performance? And does America have a general problem with that in recent years in the executive suite?
Well, one of the real problems that you should be talking about is severance packages. People fail, do things badly, have problems, are fired, sink companies, lose 401k for employees, the company loses to our win-lose discussion, and people walk off with big parachutes. Those are the things we ought to be talking about. Severance packages are terrible.
What about Dick Grasso, New York Stock Exchange, $140 million pay package? I think you've defended it.
I can't. No one's yet told me that. I don't know whether it's right or wrong, the number, but no one's told me Dick Grasso ever did anything other than compete effectively against the NASDAQ, do a whole series of things. Now, on the other hand, I don't know what the right number for Dick Grasso, but he's not a guy that did anything wrong to what I've seen anyway in the papers. Have you seen anything that he's done wrong? Anything at all?
Well, the thing ultimately seems to be that somehow public perception is that whatever he did, it wasn't worth what he was paid.
That's the board who paid him.
Yeah, and a bunch, and some of them are gone now, too.
And
We've got a million callers who want to speak with you, Jack Welch. Let me turn to them and begin to bring them in. Kailash is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Kailash. You're on the air with Jack Welch.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And compliments to Jack. If I may chide you gently, Tom, you are falling victim to the same thing that we see in the newspapers every day.
The butt economy? Am I mired in the butt economy, Kailash?
I think so. I think the reason I say that is that you've got Jack Welch, who probably, I think, has done more to deserve the title of manager of the century in terms of innovation, in terms of globalizing the economy as we know it today. I mean, my comment is, one, I don't begrudge Jack a penny he made. I think he deserved every bit. And I think that more power to people like Jack who bring innovation and who bring more jobs to our country, first thing. The second thing is that Jack has overseen the sort of the, if you will, the globalization of GE. I mean, the research centers in Bangalore, the research centers in other parts of the world. My larger concern is, are we really losing innovation from America, and what do we do to keep it here? How do we bring it back? I mean, the reason these large centers exist worldwide is, one, they have the talent there in terms of the scientific, the
person power, right?
Yeah, exactly. But really, the reason they went there in the first place is because, as a country, we had something here to innovate and to take it over there and do it with.
Kailash, our time is short before the break, but it's a great question. It's here on my list. You've raised it. I'm glad. Jack Welch, how about it? You've encouraged globalization, GE going global, many companies to go global. How does the U.S. compete? You hear the question.
Well, I think, first of all, globalization, as Kailash points out, is critical to us. Peace comes from more interaction economically. I think without question that bringing the have-nots up to what the haves have is critical. And the U.S. only chance is through innovation and education. It has been our secret for the last 30 years. Look, don't forget, in 1982 when I was running GE, people were saying the Japanese were going to take over America, and it was gone forever. Well, we adjusted our economy, created all kinds of new jobs, fix things and competed globally. But we have to compete with intellect and with education.
Is it still happening? You've been out in the field. You've seen what's happening in China, what's happening in India. Are you sanguine about where the U.S. is headed in the next generation of competition there?
The fight is going to be harder than the Japanese fight. It's going to be bigger. They're more coming at the haves. And we're going to have to get better and smarter and better educated and have more innovation. But the challenges have been on the table since World War II.
Is the country on the right path to meet those challenges now, Jack Welch?
I think so.
You do? You look out at the reports from American schools and say, that's okay, we can take on the Chinese?
I was at Stuyvesant School in New York the other day, last June for the graduation speech. You wouldn't believe the kids, the unbelievable kids. I see the people we are hiring today in GE, the young people I see in schools when I go around and talk to MBA students. Aggressive, smart, innovative. Yeah, I think do we need to bring everybody up? Of course we do. I'm working with the city of New York, Mayor Bloomberg and Chancellor Klein on the education program. We've got the most dedicated set of principals you can imagine in the toughest conditions going. And they're doing a hell of a job, Tom, in bringing along kids.
You think it'll happen? You think the competitive America is going to be there? We're talking tonight with former GE chairman Jack Welch, business legend, author of much of America's contemporary corporate culture. Do you honor Jack Welch for his championing change, innovation, big leadership rewards, and boundaryless business? Or do you fear Jack Welch's legacy for its ruthlessness, its executive hero worship, its aggressive globalization? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm joined in the studio tonight with former GE chairman Jack Welch, business legend. He's here. You can speak with him. Are you happy to live in the American corporate culture that Jack built? And do you agree with Jack Welch that it's time to celebrate a U.S. economic recovery? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Elena's on the line. Hi, Elena. You're on the air.
Hi. Enjoying your program and finally getting a chance to talk to Mr. Welch, who I very much admire. But I do want to ask him a question. When he said about rewarding bad performers, I was a General Electric employee via NBC. I worked for Canal de Noticias, NBC. They closed us down in 19...
That's a Spanish language channel?
Yes, it is.
In the United States or overseas?
In America, okay. In Charlotte, North Carolina.
Got it.
Every time I have tried to write Mr. Welch, and I have in the past, the lawyers would remind me that I signed, and please don't laugh, a severance package for about $4,000 or $5,000.
Ooh, big stuff. So what is it you want to share with Jack Welch?
I wanted Mr. Welch to know, to have a comment from him about the fact that the outfit was closed down. We weren't given an opportunity to do anything, those of us who have educated ourselves who are bilingual. The program was being run by people who didn't speak the language, didn't know the culture, and yet he's saying, don't reward the bad performers. Those people are still there. I'm out of a job.
So, Elena, are you making a small environment complaint about that particular outfit, or a larger issue here about, I don't know, Jack Welch's philosophy?
No. We are a drop in the bucket as far as NBC or General Electric is concerned. I understand that. But he is saying, don't reward the bad performers. And yet those people are still, those who were in charge, still have the job in Charlotte.
Elena, we've got it. Jack Welch, here's a voice from a far-flung corner of your one-time empire. What do you say?
Elena, you know that I'm in no position to say that the good were the bad were rewarded and the good were let go. That's not the intent of any system. I apologize to you if you were a victim of a system that didn't work right. It's never intended to be that way. It's intended to reward the best, and I'm sorry that you feel that way, and that didn't work out right for you as you see it.
Well, you mean it.
The reason I wanted to bring this up is because it happens very, very often in corporations that people feel that because they speak English perfectly, they know more than those of us who are bilingual, who have. Who know both cultures and can be a bridge with cultures, and we are not given an opportunity. And this is why I am bringing it up also.
Elena, thanks. It's an interesting point, Jack Welch, as the world goes global. You can't be only English.
Absolutely.
But I don't know if you can take that to the bank, Elena, but you've got it from the lips of Jack Welch there. Jay's on the line. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Welch is not being entirely candid with you today, Tom. I wish to address two issues.
All
one
right.
is that the moral issue of the budget deficit, the so-called growth, he is completely ignoring the emerging budget deficit, which even by the most optimistic projections of growth will be a burden for future American prosperity. He's got, and what about the tax cut? The second is, I would like his comments about the ethical dimensions of what GE did to the Housatonic River and the whole issue of the cleanup there. And he talks about ethical integrity. I would like him to address this issue of the pollution, the abject pollution of the Housatonic River.
Jay, let's get a response on those. Thanks for your call. Jack Welch.
Look, Jay, the budget deficit is clearly growing as we have two things occurring here. An economic collapse that came in before this administration. It was in August of 2000 that the economy started down. And secondly, we have a war. We did have a surplus. We're able to, when you have powder in your gun, it's the time to use it to bring the recovery back. And we're seeing in the last quarter and the quarter before that, and you'll see it in the next few quarters, a recovery. As the recovery comes and taxes are brought back from
taxes are brought back or tax revenues
increase? Revenues increase. And you'll see that deficit shrink. It only shrinks in a good economy.
But you don't buy what some economists are telling us, that it's just so big now it can't be sopped up.
It's been $400 billion before, and in the 90s we were able to clean it up. As far as the Housatonic is concerned, I'll never convince people. I wrote a chapter in my book on the PCB issue. I feel very, very strongly that the PCB issue has been demagogued. I feel that it's wrong. I feel that what GE did was always ethical and with permits from the state and federal government to do what we did. And I made the case for what we did, and I challenged anybody in my book to bring the scientific facts that would argue with my case, and I got no one in a book that sold over 2.5 million copies globally.
Do you swim there?
To argue the case. No, I don't swim in the Housatonic.
It's just a question.
I don't swim there.
Yeah.
Have you been?
No, I haven't either.
But there's a lot of people canoeing and rowing and doing things like that.
Yeah, Jay, we're not going to settle that one tonight, but thanks for your call. Adam is on the line. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Jack, you know, a lot of people in this country have an anxiety about the impact of big business on the legislators in Washington and their objectivity and being the guardians of the public trust. And I think there's a lot of myth and there's a lot of uncertainty. It would be very insightful, I think, to hear from you about your view of the impact that big business has on the objectivity and the protectorship of legislators in Washington.
Well, thanks, Adam.
It's a great question, and I'm of the view that big business is the is probably the least effective lobby in Washington, if there is one.
Even now, with all the hundreds of millions that go in there every year from the coffers?
Absolutely. Small businesses have a great lobby. The unions have a great lobby. Big business is fun to bash. It's been bashed now by Republicans, Democrats, et cetera, even though it spins off many jobs to small companies. Many small companies start as seedlings from big companies that spun them out to be more effective.
So you see the Bush administration as independent of big business influence? See Congress, Republicans and Democrats, as independent of big business influence?
My experience in for 20 years was that big business influence was far overemphasized as a reality. It just isn't a big deal.
Jack Welch, it's rare to get you. Now that we've got you here, when you look back on that career and you look where the economy is now, where the world is now, what are you proudest of? What are your regrets? What got misinterpreted? What hasn't gone the way you hoped?
Well, I'd start off with what I'm proudest of. I'm proudest of the fact that we built a meritocracy. We created lots of jobs where people reach their dreams. We put stock options from the top 200 fat cats to 45,000 people. I saw dream after dream being reached by people who were cashing options, watching their 401ks grow, et cetera. That was a great thrill. As far as regrets are concerned, Tom, I went to bat, gave it everything I had, and I don't have any regrets. I did the best I knew how to do. I used a line before. It's a golf term. I don't take mulligans. I gave it everything I had. I gave it with integrity and perseverance. I think I delivered with a team of people, sharing a value, with our largest shareowners being our employees.
And when you look at America's corporate culture over the last couple of years, any regrets about the impact of the Jack Welch philosophy, the way it was received, the way it's been interpreted, or is it a big net plus?
I think to have the Jack Welch philosophy tied to the garbage that went on in corporate America is an outrageous even statement. It's not even close to being right.
Jack Welch took the message and went the wrong direction. No, that's what I'm asking.
Jack Welch's first message every day was tell it like it is, integrity, straightforwardness. Tom, the idea that Jack Welch has anything to do with any of that stuff that went on with a few guys with bad behavior is just outrageous. It isn't there.
Fair enough. Give us your worldview for a second. What do you think about Iraq?
Well, I'm glad we went there. I think the thing is a tougher slug than all of us were led to believe. And I pray to God that we can find a way to transition the government to Iraqis without the loss of many more lives. Yesterday's helicopter thing was a dagger in the heart.
Yeah, it was. It really hurt. Jack Welch, the time is way too short, but thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Welch, former chairman of General Electric, manager of the century, Fortune says. You heard him. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the Episcopal Church ordains its first openly gay bishop. This is On Point. Before a cheering crowd of nearly 4,000 worshipers and 54 bishops, the Reverend V. Gene Robinson was consecrated as the Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire yesterday, the first openly gay man ever elevated to bishop in the Episcopal Church. But outside the University of New Hampshire's ice rink, which was converted to an ad hoc cathedral for the service, protesters railed against the installation of a gay bishop, and Anglican leaders from around the world are threatening to sever ties with the American Episcopal Church over Robinson's consecration. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who as spiritual leader of the world's 70 million Anglicans, has no real power to heal the impending schism called the division within the church, his church, a matter of deep regret. At yesterday's ceremony, Bishop Robinson's voice cracked with emotion several times. He thanked his supporters and reminded the congregation that the issues that the Episcopal Church is grappling with are bigger than just him. Here is an excerpt of Bishop Robinson's address on Sunday.
It's not about me. It's about so many other people who find themselves at the margins and for whatever reason have not known the year of the Lord's favor. Your presence here is a welcome sign for those people to be brought into the center. So I want to say the same three things I said to you on the day that you called me to be your bishop. First is, you cannot imagine what an honor it is for you to have called me. Second of all, I want to remind you of what you already know, which is that there are people, faithful, wonderful Christian people, for whom this is a moment of great pain and confusion and anger. And our God will be served if we are hospitable and loving and caring toward them in every way we can possibly muster. And they must know that if they must leave, they will always be welcome back into our fellowship. And in the meantime, that we will do everything we possibly can to reach out to them in the kind of love that God modeled for us, that Jesus modeled for us, and that God wants for us. And that's true of people who sit in your pews or sit in pews across the country or around the world. We must do everything we can to remain the brothers and sisters in Christ that we know we should be and that God wants us to be. And lastly, I'll say the same thing I said to you on June 7th. Use this time for God. This is not about me. It is not about us even. It is about a God who loves us beyond our wildest imagining. And when you go home and your next door neighbor asks you, how was it? Use it to tell them about this God of ours, this God of unimaginable compassion and love for us. The eyes of the world are on us. Let's use every inch of it. We couldn't buy this kind of publicity. But let's use it for God. There are so many people out there who are so hungry for the good news, who have no idea that they are loved the way this God loves us, and they will never hear it if you and I don't tell our stories about how God saved us. Please, use this time, this wonderful event for which I am so grateful. Use it to reach out to all those in the world who so desperately hunger for it. And know of my love for you. Thank you so much.
The new Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, V. Gene Robinson, speaking yesterday at his installation ceremony. Robinson is the Episcopal Church's first openly gay bishop. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.